Hey, BA fam, this episode is sponsored by State Farm. Are you a small business owner looking for insurance that fits your needs and budget? Look no further than State Farm. State Farm agents are not just insurance providers, they're also small business owners who live and work right here in your community. They understand the unique challenges of running and protecting a small business. When it comes to small business insurance, State Farm knows what it takes. Create a plan that fits your needs and your budget. State Farm agents are ready to help you choose personalized policies that truly understand your business. Insure your small business with a fellow small business owner. Talk to a State Farm agent today and get started on personalized small business insurance that fits your needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today. Hey, 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 guys, it's Mandy, and we're back with Brown Ambition, and obviously we are missing our beloved Tiffany so very much this week, but as promised, we have one of our favorite returning guests on the show, Lynette Calfani-Cox, a.k.a. The Money Coach, a.k.a. our fairy money godmother, as we like to say. Lynette, thank you so much for joining.
Hey, I'm so happy to be here. Fun stuff.
I have to say, we don't really have three-peat guests. I feel like you're the Tom Hanks of the Brown Ambition podcast. So what's new with you? Other than moving to Texas, having all your kids be geniuses and rocking it in college right now, what's going on in Lynette's world?
My son, you know, he's 19 now. He sent an email and it said, the subject line said, Jordan sneakers. And the email was to me and Earl and then to my ex, Akil, and his wife, Sia. And he said, hey guys, growing up, honestly, I always wanted a pair of Jordans. The problem was they were too expensive to ask for at $250. I always thought they were the coolest looking shoes. And I always said that one day when I had the money, I would buy them. I always knew exactly which ones I wanted too. The red and black Jordan ones called Air Jordan 1 Retro High OG. And so with my latest paycheck, he stayed home over spring break and he didn't come. He's at North Carolina State in Raleigh. And I said, boy, don't you want to come home? He's like, no, Ma, I want to work. So I was like, okay, fine, whatever. But he goes, and so with my latest paycheck of working spring break and extra hours, then he put in parentheses, $450 after taxes, I decided I might buy them. But then I thought of the quote, the fastest way to never own the Lamborghini company is to buy a Lamborghini, end quote. So instead of buying my shoes, I bought three pairs of Jordan / Nike stock at $84 a piece, $252 total. I'm on the road to financial power and freedom, exclamation point. Just wanted to share and let you guys know. Love, Jakarta.
Okay, that is the intro for the show, because I need you guys, Brown Ambition listeners, to know who our guest is today. This is Lynette Calfani-Cox, the woman who raised that son, that 19-year-old. Like, that is why Lynette is. That's amazing.
I was stunned. I was like, oh my God. Of course, I told him how proud I was. But at first, when I saw, you know, Jordan's, the subject line, I thought he was going to say, and then I saw it was a long email. I thought he was going to say, okay, I'm going to pay half. Can you guys give me some money and buy the other half of my Jordans?
Of course, yeah. That's the email I sent to my parents similarly.
And then when I saw him say, oh, you know, working, I said, oh, okay. I thought he was going to say, I just bought them with my own money. But yeah, when he said that he didn't even buy them, I was like, oh my God, he's listening. He's learning. I'm so happy. You know, so, there you go. I guess sometimes the parenting pays off, huh?
Yeah, I mean, you were a huge, talking about influences, I know you were a huge influence on Tiffany as she was building the Budgetnista. I haven't made the switch to entrepreneur just yet, but I think about it. I see what you all are doing, and I'm taking notes. But I mean, it's any way that you plan a life where you're able to have a family that you love and, kids who are successful in college and a business that's running smoothly and a happy marriage, it's just like you are the unicorn human, and we all need to know what your secret sauce is. So tell me more about this should, would, could to-do list and other hacks that you feel like have made this life possible.
Well, you know, there's so many, and I call them earlisms. his little pearls of wisdom. I don't know. And again, this is, it may sound like, oh, sappy and corny or whatever, but it is one of the reasons that I really do admire and respect my husband so much, is that he's constantly learning and growing and challenging himself. And he pushes me to do the same thing. And even, you know, business certainly is one thing, because literally Earl and I are so attuned, and it's not like it's all sunshine and roses. We never argue or anything like that, because we do.
Good. You're human.
And the crazy thing is that I'm dead serious. There's almost like, if I had to say what we argue about, I can almost pinpoint it. Like 9 out of 10 arguments that we would have ever had in, you know, 13, 14 years would be about money. So,
oh, I feel so seen.
And the crazy thing, so, and now let me be a little more specific about it. It's usually about a negotiation about money. So I mean, this might sound like, oh my God, does she have like a crazy sense of self-importance or what is the deal here? But I'm always that person who's like, this is what I'm worth. And this is my price. This is what I'm asking for. And Earl, who is a fabulous negotiator and a good businessman and obviously a wonderful agent, he knows what to bring me and what I'm going to totally pass and turn down. But at the same time, needless to say, he's in a bit of a bind, let's say, for playing the hubby loving role and then putting on the business agent hat as well. Because I'm sure sometimes he's thinking, 15 grand, 20 grand, or, you know, girl, you better take that check. But then he's like, oh, okay, well, what do you think about giving the scope of the work? He'll put it in professional terms or whatever. So when I say about, if we ever argue about money, we literally still will have conversations, as my pastor calls it, intense fellowship around. And it's not as bad probably as it was like 8 years ago, you know, but, you know, on occasion, you know, if there's a disagreement, it'll usually be something sort of contract related or something like that. And he'll just try to blunt it. He'll say, you know what? Tell me what you want. he's like, I'm not going to propose something here. Just tell me what you want. So, and I'm like, no, honey, that's your role. You take, just do what you know, whatever you think. He's probably like, I know that trap. I'm not going to step into that one.
No, I think there's always that power struggle of, especially when you're like, I mean, and you guys are partners in serious ways as business partners, but also just in a marriage, like just being partners to get things done. Like if you're doing a renovation or you're planning a vacation, like your partner's, you know, planning things together. And it's so easy to slip into that. Well, I can just do it this way. And that's where a lot of the fights we have as husband and wife come in is that trust around finances. Like, do I trust, or not even just finances, but like planning things or handling things, like,
right,
sure, and he can handle it, but will he handle it the right way, you know? Right. And that is, I mean, we're newlyweds, so you're probably like, uh-huh, you'll get over that pretty soon. But that's what a lot of our fights are, really the nut of it, is like the way that one of us is doing something is not the way the other person would do it.
No, and that is, I mean, literally that can happen for like 5 years, 10 years. It doesn't have to be, you know, you married a year plus now, right?
It'll be 2 years actually this weekend.
Oh, two. Oh, kudos to you. Congrats.
Thanks.
But no, this part I can honestly say, and again, with all humility, this is an example of how this permeates and how this can, you know, be reflected in many aspects of a relationship. The personal side, you know, business, parenting, career, even spirituality. So Earl and I are both Christians, but I was sort of raised in the church, you know, and so much more to an extent than he was. And so, long story short, when we got together, I almost like had this, I won't even call it an idea, but I had this sort of mindset, like I'm more exposing him to a greater or deeper sense of Christian values and et cetera, et cetera. And do you know, I had this totally wrong-headed misconception for years. And then one day, Earl, he was just kind of like breaking something down and teaching me something and talking about something. And then I was like, oh, wait a minute. I just never even like remotely knew that, had never heard of that, didn't. And he was just kind of like, oh, yeah. And he just kept on patiently going. But it was almost like, it was like a gentle way of the Lord telling me, you thought that you came into his life to help him become more, quote, Christian and more enlightened. Oh, no, girl, it's the other way around. And I was just like, oh, wait a minute. And it was just like a total epiphany for me. But sometimes if you like sit in that moment, if you can really hear, you know, what your partner is trying to tell you, or sometimes what God, I guess, is trying to tell you, you'll be the better for it. I mean, you're the beneficiary of it. But, you know, again, that's a little maturity and wisdom on that front. And I'm so happy. I'm serious to be at this point in my life because, you know, there is something to having raised kids and to be, you know, to have kids at different areas now, one who's 21, one 19, one 13, and to have gone through those phases. And then to remember, you know, where I was and I was a hot mess. So, you know, I'm happy that my kids turned out great.
So anyone who's listened to the show, you guys know Tiffany is actively planning for a family. I mean, that's the whole reason she's on this vacation right now, is to spend time really shifting the balance in her professional and personal life to actually spend some time focused on family, which is beautiful. And, you know, I've learned a lot listening to Tiffany because we're about a decade apart, Tiff and I. In age, her being older than I am, and I am absorbing all that she's saying about, you know, being in her late 30s now and trying to plan for a family. And, you know, they've obviously gone through in vitro fertilization, that process. You know, she struggled with issues that have made it not as easy to have children. And, you know, we talk all the time about, you know, getting to a place where you have space for a family and then also your career. And it sounds so cliched that we, you know, it sounds like a cliche, you know, that how do you balance both? And at this point, I'm kind of convinced that you just throw yourself in the pit and just do it. Like, just have the kid and see and make the business happen. I don't know if you have any more, you know, pearls of wisdom that actually are a little bit more structured than that advice, but that's kind of the sense I'm getting, is there's no perfect, if you're waiting for the perfect time and the perfect weather and the perfect point in your life to start the family and have the business and the career and everything, it really won't drop in your lap that way. You just kind of got to go for it when it's least scariest to you.
Yeah. And I, you know, in my opinion, I think the vast majority of people who become parents were just kind of thrown into the pit, as you said, and it was not particularly, you know, specifically planned. And I'll just give you, like, I'll share my own, you know, as an example. And my story is not necessarily illustrative of everybody's experience, obviously, but just as a point of reference, my first child, Aziza, I had her when I was 29 and she was 100% planned, like almost to the month. I had been married for 5 years already. And we knew, okay, we've been married, want to have a baby now. And so had her, and it was wonderful. My son, who came 2.5 years later, it was like, oh, surprise, I'm pregnant. Oh, okay, I guess we're having another baby. You know, it was just like, okay. And so, you know, that was fine. And then you know, that was by my ex-husband. I divorced, obviously, you know, subsequently remarried to Earl and et cetera. When Earl and I got, were pregnant with Alexis, total surprise, 100% surprise, before we were married. And I was like, oh my God, what have I done? Like, what? And I was like, okay, I guess I'm having a baby again here. Whoa, you know. And I was 37 when I had Alexis. And so, you know, I am in all three experiences, even though they were all completely different, I'm so happy for, you know, what developed. And I think that a lot of times, especially as women, we do, you know, try to just, you know, plan every little thing and try to, you know, hope for that opportune time or that sign or that right, you know, XYZ, where we're hoping that everything aligns. And it's okay to get a little, you know, to feel a little out of your comfort zone and just kind of say, okay, I'm going to have to go with this and roll with the punches and see how this works out. You know, how,
well, I just realized I was doing the math. Sorry to interrupt. I realized, so your third daughter, your third child, so she was born right around the time that you were launching the Money Coach.
Correct.
So you launched your business and had your third baby in the same time period.
Correct. Correct. Yep. That's absolutely correct. I launched the moneycoach.net in 2003, and then Alexis was born in 2005, at the end of 2005. But yeah, I mean, really in terms of starting the business in earnest and a whole bunch of other, you know, things that I can, you know, write in another book and just, you know, putting myself out there in a lot of ways where time was at a premium, energy, you know, financial resources, et cetera, paying alimony and child support to my ex, you know, just a whole bunch of stuff. So, 'twas not easy. I can say that, you know, but I really do think that I would hope that your audience would take heart and would, you know, be encouraged if it feels like, geez, you know, it doesn't seem like I'm ever going to have the right exact time. And, you know, this is not like, okay, qualifying for a mortgage, right? Where, you know, okay, my score needs to be X in order to have approval, or I need 10% down payment, or 5% or 20%, or there's no hard and fast benchmark to tell you, yes, 100% now is the right time for motherhood, or launching a business, or doing them both simultaneously. You know, sometimes you really do have to say, okay, I'm gonna go for it. And even though I don't have all the answers, you know, it's like Martin Luther King said, you know, you don't have to see the whole staircase, just take the first step, you know. And that was to give people guidance and permission to move and to move forward. And to you know, kind of have a little faith and some trust in the process, that even if, you know, nothing is so catastrophic that, you know, it can't be undone, fixed, amended, et cetera. My pastor wrote a book, as a matter of fact, called Failure is Written in Pencil. And I love that title because it really does speak to the fact that it's okay if you make a mistake, even if you quote unquote fail or don't succeed at something. Erase that stuff, move on, fix it, you know, change. It's not like that has to define you or hold you back forever.
Were there ever times when you're building your business and raising your children when you felt like you were failing in one area, like the business side, or you had fear of failing on the parenting side?
Oh, to be honest, I never had fear of failure on the business side. I'm one of those people who, my sister said she took some test, just like a personality and a business test, and it said her confidence level was like off the charts. She had me to do the same thing, and it was pretty much the same for me. I know I will succeed. If I, on a financial terms or on a business terms, lost everything that I had, you know, tomorrow, I know I could create that and more again, you know, the next day, the next month. So I don't worry about that on the business side. As a parent, yes. And the main things that I've worried about as a parent are connecting with my kids, especially my son, and also just being present. So, you know, I've had times where, you know, I've been on vacation with the family and, you know, I'm constantly taking my laptop and I was like writing an article, writing another chapter. And I was doing that a lot. And I was doing it for so long that it caught up with me. And I said, this is crazy. This is like a little sick. This is not good and healthy. This is not life balance. So I started saying to Earl, I don't want to be here. And you're like, okay, I'm going to take Alexis to the pool. I'm going to go out to the beach. You know, no, I should be out there enjoying it too, you know? And so, you know, so now I catch myself and I'm like, nope. You know, it's not that I never take my laptop. I do. but I'm much, much, much more mindful. And certainly the last 2 to 3 years in particular, I've been extraordinarily present and very conscientious about, you know, just my intentions, that my goal is to have chill time, to have downtime with the family, to be present, to not to let everything else kind of go away for a little while. And a therapist helped me with that actually too. When my, you know, about a year after my sister Debbie passed away, I had gone through grief counseling at my church, and, you know, just, it was obviously very rough. My sister passed away at age 49, totally unexpectedly. And then about a year, maybe a year and a half later, I just would go through these bouts again of just crying a lot, being so sad and just obviously missing her. But then also in other ways, I started having arguments with Earl, and I was like, this is really not like us to just, you know, argue over ridiculous, you know, little stupid stuff. So anyway, went to a therapist, and, you know, she was very, very helpful. And one of the things that she helped me to see was travel. And she said, okay, so let me get this straight. She said, you know, part of how you and Earl got together and part of your history as a couple, part of the beauty of what you guys did was you worked and played together. You traveled a lot for business together. You traveled a lot personally together. And she said, so now all of a sudden I see one thing you said in the last year and a half, you kind of like cut that off. And she's like, why'd you do that? And then I said, well, you know, I got a kid in college. I got one on the way. I got, you know, I'm trying to save money. I'm trying not to, you know. And then she was like, she didn't say it in these words, but she was pretty much like, no, you can afford it. She was like, if this is about your mental happiness and your sanity and blah, blah, blah. So we talked through that. And then she said, but let me ask you something. She said, when you're going and, you know, traveling, you and Earl, or you, Earl and Alexis, are you like working, you know, and I was like, all the time. I told her, I said, I always take my laptop. He takes his, blah, blah, blah. So she said, okay, I suspected that. She's like, I don't want you to take your laptop on the next vacation. And I said, no, you don't understand. She said, have you ever gone on vacation without? And I said, nope, not once. I said, on our honeymoon, when we were on like a 10-day cruise, we both had our laptops. No, we got, she said, your business will be just fine. Nothing's going to happen. The business is not going to go away. You're not going to miss some crucial. You'll be just fine. So she kind of talked me off that ledge. And she said, I tell you what, even if you guys are not able to like literally leave your laptops at home, I want you to agree to yourselves on a limit, on a finite amount of time and a very brief time. Like when you go on your next vacation, and we had said, okay, let's do a cruise. When you go on that cruise, give yourself a limit. So I came home, I told Earl about the whole, you know, everything and the epiphanies I was having in the session. He was like, she's right. Yep. You know what? He goes, book our thing now. So I booked us. I was like, oh, you don't have to tell me twice. I like booked a week long vacation, a cruise, you know? And then I said, oh, but you know, she said we really shouldn't take our laptops. He was like, I don't know about all that. I said, or she said we could just have a limit. So we said, okay, we agreed on 1 hour, not 1 hour each day, 1 hour total for a 7-day vacation. Okay.
Oh, wow.
So, and we stuck to it. It was so awesome. I mean, I was like, oh, this is so relaxing. This is so free. I love it. And, like she said, nothing, you know, nothing went to hell in a handbasket. I mean, it was just like, but it really showed me even more. I was able to be present in a much more tangible way. I could just can remember the smells of everything and just, you know, special dinners that we had and, you know, Alexis, you know, going off to kids camp and sliding down the water slide. I remember like everything. So, it's true that, you know, just kind of being aware and being cognizant of kind of what you're doing in a given moment, it's so super important to not have all your attention all the time divided. I mean, you know, I know we all think we can multitask and all that, but I think there's some science behind that too, that shows, you're really like sacrificing your attention on one thing and kind of compensating in other areas.
All right, BA fam, y'all know when it comes to financial advice, you have to trust your source. That's why you listen to Brown Ambition, right? And when I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. I've been a longtime fan of NerdWallet. In fact, I almost worked there a couple of times because when it comes to financial experts and writing, they really know how to give you the best reviews of financial products. I honestly wouldn't sign up for a credit card today if I hadn't looked at a review on a site like NerdWallet myself. And honestly, if y'all haven't learned about NerdWallet, you're missing out. And with their help, what could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access, wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms of each credit card issuer apply.
Hey guys, we're back with our guest, Lynette Calfani-Cox, the Money Coach. Here's my next question, Lynette. How do you guys plan out things when you're, so you do travel as a certain percentage of your income each month? Do you also, how do you save for retirement? You're saving for two retirements.
Right. Absolutely not the latter. And I probably drive Earl a little crazy with this because I'm extremely aggressive about it. And I, you know, kind of insist on a lot of retirement savings. So, again, we own an S corp, our, for federal tax purposes, our company, our LLC is an S corp, but, essentially what it means is that as self-employed people, we are both employer and employee. So we file a K-1 and we, earn dividend income and salaried income. Again, we pay ourselves a salary, a given salary. So we have W-2 income that we pay ourselves. All of that matters because we're able to sock away a much larger percentage of money than a traditional W-2 employee. So for 2019, for example, now you can sock away $19,000 for people who are, you know, under 50 or $25,000 if you're 50 and older, but we can actually sock away something like $55,000 or $56,000 is the new limit for 2019. And that's because taking into account the employer and the employee contribution side of things. So long story short, we max out. So, but I'm like, I know it hurts to put that in there, you know, to write those checks, but it's, you know, it's what we got to do and what I feel is the best thing for us. Wow. to be aggressive in our retirement savings. And no, I don't wait to the end and or wait till, oh, this is how much I have left over. It's like, you got to put that money in there. So
yeah,
and that's our strategy, but yeah.
Well, and I haven't, you know, my husband's always had his 401k. I've always had mine. I haven't looked at his. I mean, I know we know roughly what's in each of them and what percentage we're saving, but we haven't really figured out like, okay, I don't know what he's investing in. I know what I'm investing in and I feel fine, but it's hard to, you know, I just save my 10% and he saves his 10% and I just hope for the best. I don't know. I would like to be more aggressive, but I think it's been a lot easier to talk myself out of being more aggressive in the past couple of years because we've done things like buy a house and do a renovation. And, you know, I'm just, you know, trying to find a way to, you know, afford like a vacation for the summer. And it is like so incredibly easy to talk yourself out of, you know, doing a little bit extra toward that nest egg. But, you know, I don't know where we're going to be in another 40 years and if I'll keep the job I have or if I won't. And I feel like it's only going to get more expensive and we should be ratcheting up our savings each year, but we've definitely fallen into a little bit of that trap of like, there's so much other competing, you know, priorities right now. And, you know, we have plenty of time to save more for retirement.
Yeah, and you do, and I can tell you again, as a parent of, you know, 21-year-old, 19 and 13, to reiterate, it is, that never goes away. So we're constantly like, oh my God, there's so many things to be done. All, and so Earl, he told me, it was so funny, about maybe a month ago, he said, I said, are you grouchy about something? What's going on? And he said, oh, he said, I guess I just feel like, you know, every dollar is earmarked for something. And he was like frustrated about that. And I said, honey, it's supposed to be. That's called budgeting. <You know? laughs> And so, but in his mind, he was like, okay, this, you know, even seeing like, okay, I'm gonna put a $10,000 here towards retirement. I said, but that's for you. That's savings. You know, that's helping to build your net worth. And that's helping to, you know, ensure your future financial security when you're no longer working. And we're on an aggressive, you know, plan towards being what I call work optional. So in 5 more years, when Alexis goes off to college, you know, we can work, and, you know, knowing us, since we're both workaholics, we will still be working. But I really want to be at that point where we're work optional, where kids' colleges are paid for, retirement assets are very, very, very nicely funded. We still travel as much as we want. And we've made commitments to our kids because we're very intentional about multi-generational planning, what our intentions are for them and what we plan to do. So, for example, we've told them that we want to cover you for your education and we don't want you to have any student loan debt. We told them that we're going to buy you your first house, a condo initially for each one of them. We've told them that we want to start you off with a car so that if you need transportation, you'll have a car and, you know, you won't have to, you know, have a giant note or whatever. And we want to help them to have that kind of head start in life that certainly neither one of us had, but that will help them to be able to build from a position of strength. So, you know, you already know 7 out of 10 students are coming out of college right now with student loan debt, like $38,000 worth. And so we're like, nope, don't want them to be part of that statistic. And, you know, I had 40 grand when I came out of college, when I got out of grad school. And so I just know how much that kind of puts you behind the eight ball. So even like with my daughter, the 21-year-old who is now working, she graduated one semester early from UT Austin in December. And she came to me recently and she said, oh, mom, I want to pay rent. Now, we bought her a condo. She has 2 roommates. The mortgage on the condo is $1,400 a month. The 2 roommates pay $1,400 a month. And I was like, Aziza, what do you mean you want to pay rent? Like, there's nothing for you to pay. And, you know, and she says, oh, I want to have one room. I want to have my own privacy, but I also want to be financially responsible. Like, this is, I can do it. And, you know, and I said, Aziza, remember, I got this so you could have a, you know, a start and you could save your money. That's the whole point of this. She said, Ma, you did it. It worked. I've been living rent free for 3 years. You know, she says, I have a full-time job and I'm still saving half my income. She's a crazy aggressive saver. So
I wonder who she gets it from.
So I told her, okay, so the plan is in September, she's going to start paying rent. And so, and honestly, when she laid everything out for me, she showed me her budget. I was like, I can't even argue with her. So I was like, okay, you know, so it's just, it is a good thing to see, you know, younger people start off on the right foot.
Why is that so important for you? And talk a little bit about that. Cause I think I come from a similar background in that, you know, if not very many people, my family went to college and, you know, I graduated with blessedly a little bit of debt because I just decided not to live in campus housing and that saved my butt. But, you know, going out into the world, having debt, not really having parents who could financially support you, I feel I'm starting to feel the same way about when I'm thinking about my kids, is wanting to give them the same give them a head start that I didn't have. Now, yours sounds way more generous than I. Like, that sounds amazing. To be able to give your child like a condo and all that. But where does that come from? And do you wish that more people would do that for their children? Because I can hear some people saying like, well, you're just going to raise like spoiled kids who, you know, don't know how to pay their bills and things like that.
Right. And I, you know, where it comes from for me, is A, my own personal background and experience and knowing what it's like to struggle through, to have college debt, to have credit card debt, to have had my car repossessed, to have known what it's like to financially struggle through a whole bunch of issues. And then also knowing the other side. You'd be shocked at how many parents really are doing this for their kids. In communities of color, unfortunately, it is not the norm. It is not, you know, kind of the, and certainly what we're talking about doing is you know, probably obviously the exception rather than the rule. However, many, many millennials that I talk to who are white will tell me flat out that their parents are either paying their rent, paying their car payment or their insurance, that they gave them the money for their down payment on their house. It's extremely common. And then at another level, intergenerationally, you know, I'm also a money expert for AARP. And so I get to talk to, even though I'm a Gen Xer, I get to talk to a lot of folks who are baby boomers and members of the silent generation, their 50s and 60s and beyond. And one of the regrets that a lot of people actually articulate is that they do regret helping those children who became financially dependent or who were not prudent in their use of the money. And a lot of times it's something like, oh, I invested $40,000 in my son's business and it went belly up. Or, you know, my daughter told me to invest in this stock or that, or tried to do this real estate venture and it didn't work out. And, you know, things like that. I'm trying to literally invest in my kids themselves. I'm trying to give them a leg up and do so in a way where not only am I, you know, telling them that I have a great deal of faith and confidence in them, I'm laying out expectations as well. So just like the reason that we first bought our daughter Aziza a condo was in her freshman year, she did poorly, very poorly. And she had won all this scholarship money. And first semester, she just totally bombed, you know, and I was kind of looking at her grades like, what? This is not my Aziza. What's going on here? Having been an A student and a, you know, had a 2230 SAT when she, you know, she had done extremely well. However, her second semester, she bounced back and then, you know, she kept continuing to, you know, make progress. And then junior year, I think it was, she came home Christmas break. She had straight A's. It was just like her normal self. But because that first semester she faltered, at the end of her first year, she did not have a 3.5 GPA overall, which was what was required. So she lost her scholarship. So the difference, you know, roughly, you know, $50,000 all in for tuition fees, room and board as an out-of-state student from New Jersey attending Texas, the difference between that and paying in-state tuition, you know, was, you know, threefold. So initially, I started looking for a strategy to decrease our out-of-pocket costs, and then I learned that, oh, she can establish residency in the state. She loves Texas. She wants to stay there. We know she wants to stay there. She's already telling us that. We can buy her a property, and that, after she owns it for 1 year and lives there for 1 year, she'll become a resident of the state of Texas. And so that's literally exactly what we did. And she did, in fact, of course, become a resident and still lives there. And so it was a strategy actually for reducing tuition after a totally unexpected kind of slip up on her part. Now, some people might start with that and say, are you kidding me? A kid who had poor grades, you doubled down on her. You said, I'm going to buy her a condo. Like, who would do that? Again, I would not recommend this in general to most people. I would say only to a parent, you know, your child. And I knew Aziza. I was like, the girl is a superstar, you know, hands down. I knew that she had a lot of transition issues and that in the course of sort of, you know, asking myself and everybody else, what happened? How could this even have, you know, as much as I try to plan and you know, create an environment for success, this didn't happen. I found out that the average student who goes into college suffers a 0.5 drop in their GPA from senior year of high school to freshman year of college. So even a student who was, say, a 3.9 GPA as a senior in high school will typically have a 3.4 GPA after their freshman year of college. So now, again, knowing that.
Well played, scholarship terms writers.
Exactly. So with my son, he probably was like, oh my God, he probably was like, mom is never going to, you know, she's going to be all over me. And sure enough, I was. So I was like, Jakarta, you see what happened with Aziza. You have to, that first semester, you think I was a helicopter parent before. I was like, you know, helicopter, drone, you know, satellite, cruise missiles. I mean, I was all up in this boy's stuff. But he was on the dean's list his first semester, you know, so it worked. But he knows as well. That's the strategy for him because he's at a public university. He's in Raleigh at North Carolina State University. Our family doesn't really qualify for much need-based aid. He did win some scholarships, about $7,000 or so worth, and the rest we pay. And he knows that in his sophomore year, really at the, you know, at the end of this freshman year, in the summertime, we're going to buy him a condo. And then he's going to establish residency. And then the beauty of that strategy is that not only do you take your tuition down by about a third, you know, to about a third of its cost, they basically have housing free of charge as well. So it's a super effective strategy. But as we, again, it was born out of and us saying we're going to buy them a condo and a house and all that. We had sort of nebulous, you know, just like, oh, yeah, we want to help our kids and give them a launching, you know. But now because this actually happened with Aziza and we've seen, we're like, oh, this is a quick and easy way to do it. And it meets multiple goals. So we'll give them that start later if they want to sell, if they get married, if they, you know, that's on them, that they can do what they want. But I do think it's important, especially to try to help build multi-generational wealth, to leave your kids something besides some debts. So
how does that work? Is the deed in their name or is the deed in your name until, you know, they graduate? What are the rules on this whole arrangement?
Okay, so great question. It's in all of our names. So obviously at the time, you know, Aziza was not, she did not have a job. She could not obviously get a mortgage or qualify for any kind of home loan, anything like that. So she is on the mortgage and she is on the deed. And then Earl and I are on, of course, both as well, the mortgage, because we're actually paying it, and on the deed. So the student must be on the deed. And different states have different rules. In Texas, I believe, don't 100% quote me, I don't think that they even care if you're on the mortgage or not, but you have to be on that deed for sure. And obviously you have to physically, you know, have residency and literally live in the property. So it doesn't work just to have an apartment, a timeshare, a rental, something like that. They want to know that you are a property owner, paying your taxes and, you know, and that, and it's fine if the parents are even paying it. Or a roommate pays it, or somebody else, you know, it doesn't matter who, but you have to be listed as the property owner via the deed for that property. So again, I'm going to do the exact same strategy with Jakarta, and he's loving Raleigh. you know, has a little girlfriend out there and everything. So he's he'll stay. And I'm like, I tell my kids that, fly, little birdies, just, you know, don't come back home. Just, you know, not to live anyway. Just, you know, do you, it's time to go off and, you know, explore. And that's why I'm so glad, because Aziza, she interned, you know, at a place out in Austin. And then, you know, of course they made her a job offer, and that's where she's working now. She's doing great. So it all really did work out.
Fabulous. So are you juggling mortgages now, or do you have it set up to where your kids have roommates who are paying rent, and then really you guys don't have a mortgage to worry about?
Yeah. So the property in Austin does have a mortgage on it, and the mortgage is $1,400 a month. And the two roommates, though, basically we pay the mortgage, obviously, every month. And then the two roommates send us their payments, which are $1,400 a month.
Gotcha.
So in effect, it's really no. Well, we do pay the HOA fees, and it's $220 a month for the HOA fees. And we just, you know, write the check for ourselves and just do that.
Gotcha. And then same with the Sun in Raleigh, are we able to pay cash? I mean, I'm just thinking about how much more affordable real estate is when you get out of the Northeast.
Oh, yeah, totally. So he is, you know, this is the second semester for him in his freshman year. So he is not done with his, you know, this year at all. So until May. But yes, in the summertime, in June is, and probably I'll probably really look, you know, May or June, but sometime before August, before he actually goes back to school in his sophomore year, we will purchase and close and buy a condo out there for him as well. And near, you know, universities, it's because most campuses, you know, space is at a premium, and my kids happen to, you know, like big, you know, national universities, like UT Austin has 50,000, you know, kids on camp. I'm not on camp, 50,000 students. And so, NC State has, I don't know, 40 something thousand too. So, and they're required to live on campus their first year, but then after that, the kids can move off campus. And I, my kids know, even Alexis, who's 13, knows she will be living on campus the first year. Depending if she decides to go to a college in state, then great. As you get in state tuition, and you know, the housing thing is not that much of a big deal. But so far, both of my kids have told me that, oh yeah, everybody who's an upperclassman, you know, juniors and seniors, they definitely want to be off campus. They don't want to stay on campus. So I guess they, you know, start feeling themselves and feeling like, I'm grown, I want to have my own place and blah, 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 and not have to be in a dorm or whatever. But we will do the same strategy with Jakarta. We have not yet purchased a place for him, but yes, we definitely will. And again, the goal there is to knock his out-of-state tuition that we're paying to in-state levels. And it doesn't happen immediately, because you have to still, he has to live there for 1 year, but in his junior year, that's when it kicks in, and in his senior year. And right now he's in the architecture program, which is actually a 5-year program. So it pays off even more.
Yeah. I mean, why spend tens of thousands of dollars to the university when you can just invest that in property? And then you've got, it makes so much sense. I know it sounds, you know, obviously it's risky and you have to be in a good financial position to do it, but I totally see why you guys did it.
Yeah.
So many goals. Okay. My brain is going now. I'm like, okay, I've got to get the house fund for my child set up that I don't even have yet. All right. Awesome.
Well, 529 plan. Just start with the 529 plan.
Well, let's take a quick break and we'll be right back out and we'll close the show with a boost and break. And we're back. Lynette, I cannot thank you enough for coming on the show. I miss Tiffany, but it's been the best excuse in the world that I could get to spend an hour and a half talking to you. But I'm dying to hear what your brown booster break is. This is Tiff and I, our signature segment, which doesn't really make sense if you think about it, but it just works for us. We always take either a boost or a break. Do you want me to go first? Do you want to go first?
You go first.
Okay, I'm going to do a boost. One, I always talk about my lovely accountant, Paul. I want to do a boost for myself because I finally went in and adjusted my withholdings for 2019 because this year I still haven't gotten the right calibration of my taxes where I'm not getting back a refund and I'm not owing anything. This year I ended up owing federal but got back state and it netted out to be zero, but I'm trying to get to the point where I don't owe any federal and I don't get that much of a refund. So tweaking my withholdings for 2019, and I got to say, I felt really grown up doing it. Like, it's not that hard.
Very cool. I love it. And this is the year to do it because of tax reform, obviously. So many people got a surprise. Either they didn't get as big a refund as they had been anticipating, or they owed. So you absolutely should be adjusting your withholding. And yeah, it's a very simple thing to do. So good for you.
Thank you, ma'am. What about you?
So mine is a break, and that's what we're calling it, right?
Brown break. You got it.
So, and mine is like, I'm so ticked off at the number of scams that are affecting older folks. And I really do feel like it affects communities of color in particular, because so many people are getting scammed out of their hard-earned money in a variety of ways. So let me just do a little 30-second thing here. You know, right now, the U.S. Attorney General, William Barr, everybody's thinking about him because of, you know, the Mueller report and all this other stuff. But most of your audience probably does not know that just 2 weeks ago, he announced the largest ever federal crackdown on elder fraud. And basically, the feds charged 225 people with bilking something like 2 million older folks out of more than $750 million. So the scammers are out in full effect. And, you know, by some estimates, older people get robbed to the tune of $37 billion annually. So there's a lot of elder fraud going on. And the really sad part is that sometimes it's, you know, family members, friends, people who know the older person. So my thing is, I want to tell people to be on the lookout and to, you know, watch out for mama, big mama, auntie, you know, and anybody who you know and love, because it's really sad to see people who've worked their whole lives get ripped off in the kind of the prime of their lives.
No, I love that. My dad's a bus driver in Atlanta. He drives the bus for the city. And one day he told me he was taking some stock picking advice from a young man riding the bus who just come home from New York City, where he had been a stock trader, and moved back to Atlanta and now wanted to give my dad, you know, stock advice on how to pick penny stocks. And I was like, Daddy, please don't take advice from the man riding the bus who just came home from New York City. And I was like, ever since then, my dad runs all of his financial decisions by his children. He was actually just texting me today because he realized robocallers are a thing.
Like,
especially now, because they're calling and saying that, you know, you owe the IRS money and you're going to get arrested. He's like, who are these people? And he's trying to call them back. And I'm just like, Daddy, again, please, your finances must go through us. So no, but all jokes aside, that's a really great brown break, because it's scary to think that your parents can be scammed or your loved ones can be scammed. And sometimes they'll be too embarrassed and they won't tell you until it's too late. So I agree.
And you brought it up because it's tax time. You know, the IRS literally put out a statement about it as well. There's so much, you know, fraud going on. But the con artists, the scamsters of the world, they really do prey upon the elderly. And yeah, they'll tell them things like you owe the IRS, or they'll spoof the IRS phone number or something that appears to be the IRS and then call and say, here, pay us now. And just it's a shame. So like I said, we got to kind of look out.
Well, I'm going to put a link. I know a great resource from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. They've got a guide to spotting elder fraud and elder abuse. So I'll pop a link to that in the show notes. And Lynette, tell the people where they can find you. So if they want to get their fix of the Ask the Money Coach, how can they find you guys?
Sure. They can reach me at our free financial advice site, askthemoneycoach.com. We have about 1600 plus articles online about, you know, 26 different categories of personal finances. on social, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and LinkedIn. And then our video-based platform is moneycoachuniversity.com. Got free courses and some paid ones as well there too.
Love it. Thank you so much for filling in for Tiffany
this week. You're so welcome.
I'm so inspired.
Oh, I have to connect with her. And I'm glad she's taking off time and she's going to get her work and life balance and, you know, get it all together because it's super important. You know, we all have to set our priorities. And I'm happy for her to do just that.
Well, 4 years ago when we started the show, we were both just like, families, what? Babies, marriage, what? And it's just so fun to, it's fun to looking from the outside to see even just how far Tiff's come and how far I've come. And I'm excited for, I'm not worried about her one bit. She's going to be fine. But we're thinking of you, Tiff. If you're listening, stop listening, go back to your vacation.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.